In the first hour of the show today, we will be looking for your questions on children's health, something that we do every month on the program, always on a Thursday, and generally with the same guy who's been stopping by to do this now with us for quite a long time, Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician, clinical assistant professor at University of Illinois. And whatever questions you might have on your mind, you can certainly pick up the telephone and give us a call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long-distance call for you, and you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, or maybe even you're listening on the internet, if you want to call in, you can use the toll-free line and calls on us. That's 800-222-9455. And then, of course, we do have the local number as well. And anybody here in Champaign-Urbana wants to call, use that number. That's 333-9455. At any point here, if you have questions, you can call us. Welcome back.
Well, good morning. It's always good to be back.
Well, we're glad to have you here. Before we got, you're always here a little bit early, and so we sit around and we talk, you, me, the producers, you know, we always chat about things before we get going and talk a lot about the same things that we talk about here on the program. And we were kind of talking about the fact that recently there seems to be a lot of news about the health of America's children and how maybe it's not quite what it should be. And there's particularly been a lot of attention in the media about kids who are overweight and the growing, maybe it's not enormous, but a growing number of children who have diabetes, which that seems to be related to the weight issue. And that's something people are really concerned about. That certainly is a concern. But overall, I guess I'd wonder, well, so, okay, if you really ask the question, overall, this is a big generalization, if you ask how healthy are America's children, that probably they are pretty healthy, and compared to the past generations, they probably are healthier. You think?
I think that, yes.
Or
I
no, mean, wor- they're and no
I,
worse
And I
off?
Think, you know, certainly, I mean, the life expectancy of the American is... Well, it's not by any means. I think some of the European countries have a longer life expectancy, but our life expectancy keeps going up. It's getting longer. So I think in general, childhood health, adult health, health in general is getting better. And it probably relates to a lot of things, and it probably relates to a lot of our pharmaceuticals. And unfortunately, maybe it doesn't relate as much as it could to healthy lifestyles. Diet and exercise and that sort of stuff, and probably we're getting more sedentary. Unfortunately, it's probably because of the TV screen. Be it connected to cable or the dish network, or be it connected to a computer processor, CPU, we probably could do much better about, being more active, watching our diet. But I think... Yeah, it is a problem. It is a concern. Body mass indexes are going up. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe in this country what we're having is the fitter getting fitter, because you read articles about overuse syndromes. There was an article a couple months ago in the New York Times about athletic children who are needing knee replacement, and their athletic career is over already because they've just overtrained and kind of put 50,000 miles on their joints at age 12, 13, 14, 15. And so we've got the fit getting fitter, overly fit and wearing themselves out, and we got the fat getting fatter. So it seems that we've gone to both extremes, which I guess is not unusual for Americans or probably for anybody to go to extremes. And I think I think we just need to be a little bit more sensible and Watch your diet, watch your weight, watch your activities, and sort of, I think like we've talked about before, kind of keep your life in balance. Work, play, eat, enjoy activities and fellowship, and we should be okay.
Is checking, or maybe I would say at what point is checking children's blood sugar something that is a standard thing that you do? or is it a standard thing that you do?
You know, I retired before the type 1B or whatever you want to call it, this other peculiar diabetes that's not type 1 and not type 2. In fact, there was an article in the paper about this. Other endocrinologists are talking about this peculiar diabetes that's seen mainly in obese adolescents, mm-hmm. and mainly, unfortunately, in people of color, in Hispanics and African Americans, for some reason. And it does seem to be related to weight. And I guess it is. They're finding that it is a peculiar diabetes. Type 1 diabetes is insulin dependent. It's the one we saw in kids where they suddenly became diabetic. And what happened with these kids is, for some reason, their islet cells, the insulin-making cells in the pancreas, just disappeared. They just died and disappeared. Type 2 diabetes, or the formerly adult-onset diabetes that usually was associated with, later adulthood, middle age or later, and overweight. And what happens with those people is they make insulin. They continue to make insulin. They continue to make excessive quantities of insulin. But for some reason in them, because insulin antibodies and that, the insulin works less well. So usually those are, the children with type 1 diabetes need insulin because their body's just not making it. The adults with type 2 diabetes, often diet or medication can control it, and they don't need to go to injectable insulin. This type 2 diabetes that's seen in kids is, and I think we've talked about it before, probably type 2 is, it's a type 1B or 1.5 or something like that.
It's somehow different than what you see in adults who end up developing it later in life. But that also seems to have something to do with weight.
Yes. Weight and race.
Right.
And genetic makeup. Yeah. But these kids can go into ketoacidosis. They can have the trouble of type 1, but usually they're sort of a type 2. They may need insulin, and they're just strange. They're different. They fit in neither class or both classes. Just split the difference. But I think, in general, probably, again, immunizations. I think we are one of the best immunized countries in the world. In general. That's not exactly true either. For those that are fortunate enough to have insurance, they tend to be well immunized. For those that tend to be poor, they tend to be less well immunized, which is unfortunate.
Well, going back to this issue of I think you said that this concern about this diabetes in kids sort of came up after you retired, and I guess I'm wondering now, have there been new recommendations, or are doctors thinking any differently about checking, doing blood sugar checks on kids, or would you only do that once you really suspect? You wouldn't do that as a routine thing. You'd only do that once you really suspected there might be a problem.
Yeah, probably if you have obesity, you do it routinely. Mm. And probably the best one to do is the so-called two-hour postprandial. 2 hours after breakfast, you grab a blood sugar. Fasting blood sugar, or you can do a 2 hour postprandial will give you the best information. Mm-hmm. And the old glucose tolerance tests are sort of uncommonly done anymore.
Okay. We're here open to whatever questions people might have. It's the morning of the month that we talk about children's health, and our guest is pediatrician Dr. Robert Bochak. So if you want to call in here, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Maybe we get in a plug for people to, because this weekend, we have already this summer had some very hot temperatures, and it looks like this weekend, I heard this morning our meteorologist, Ed Kieser, say that we might see some of the hottest temperatures that we have seen in years, not just the hottest this summer, but maybe the hottest in years. We might, make a pitch for keeping this in mind. Watch your outdoor activity. If you are going to be doing things outdoors, make sure you get really well hydrated, and just maybe, find something else to go to the library, movies, something other than spending a lot of time running around outside.
Maybe this is a good time to spend as much time as you want on the computer, where it's air conditioned. If they say watch the farm animals, certainly watch the human animals too, because
when the livestock safety index is up there, you be concerned about kids too. It's not just about the livestock.
I gave some misinformation last month, believe it or not. some lady called about pitting in her adopted child, as I recall, that had some pitting on the fingernails.
Mm-hmm.
And I said it could be a nutritional deficiency, namely iron. I was wrong. Iron deficiency can cause a nail deformity, but it causes a spooning of the nails. Pitting of the nails is associated with psoriasis or alopecia areata. Alopecia areata is a peculiar disease. It's an autoimmune disease against the hair where just patches of hair fall out. Or more commonly than anything else, pitting of the nails is just pitting of the nails. It means nothing. So for that woman who called last month, I apologize. And probably pitting of her nails, because we asked about other skin conditions and there were none in that child. So this pitting of the nails, just ignore.
So you wouldn't treat it? You wouldn't even put a little cortisone cream on it or anything like that? So you just say, wouldn't worry about it?
Don't worry about it.
Okay. Very good. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you want to ask a question, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455.
And I was by my old office the other day, and apparently they are quite bored. They're just doing
nothing
school physicals,
going on.
Sport physicals.
Oh, well, yeah.
And Fifth disease is out there. And Fifth disease is a peculiar viral disease. It's caused by a parvovirus. And for the vast majority of people, it's a who cares. It presents as a rash. And the so-called slap cheek appearance, the cheeks get very red. It looks like you slapped the child on both cheeks. And then they'll develop a lacy rash, usually on the shoulders and the extensor surface of the arms. They are not sick. They just have this rash. It lasts for a few days. It fades away. And by and large, it's a who cares, except in people who have chronic anemia, like those with sickle cell disease, those with hereditary spherocytosis, and a few things, because it tends to shut down the bone marrow for a few days. And for those of us who are perfectly normal, who carry our hemoglobin of 12 or 14 or something, oh, the hemoglobin drops down to 8 or 9, and we don't know anything. But if you're carrying a hemoglobin of 9 and it drops down to 5 or 4 or 5, that's significant. You're in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, Fifth disease is in a healthy person, it's a who cares.
Okay.
It's a funny rash.
One thing I thought we might mention, and this is an exception to our generally talking about children's health, but I saw an article about this the other day, and I thought, you know, anytime that we had a doctor on the show, it might be worth mentioning, and it has to do with tetanus. And basically, the article was saying that, you know, we do, again, for those kids who we can immunize, we do a good job immunizing children, basically, for tetanus, but that you should have, once you get older, and I guess every 10 years, you're supposed to have a booster for that. And in fact, if you look at the people who do get tetanus in the United States, they're all adults. And it's because, apparently, it's because at some point their immunity from however many immunizations they've gotten has deteriorated, and they're not immune anymore. And obviously, they're not getting those updates. For the first shot, for the DPT that we're going to give to infants, how long is that thought to be good for? And is there a regular schedule, you know, a regular time that even within a pediatrician that you would do booster shots for tetanus for kids?
Yeah, usually, there's a series of three in the first year of life, in the first 6 months of life. There's a booster at 18 months. There's a booster at kindergarten. And then we go to every 10 years after that.
Oh, okay.
Unless there's a particularly tetanus-prone wound. If there's a dirty wound, you stabbed yourself with a garden pitchfork in the foot, then it would be every 5 years. And that may be – no, that schedule is probably not going to change. What may change is the addition of the acellular pertussis vaccine, and I think we've talked about this several times on this show that, pertussis is a problem for young children. The morbidity mortality is in young children, but the source of the spread, again, after age 10 or so, 7 or 10, we adults aren't immune to pertussis anymore. So then we are the source that could possibly give it to a young infant where it's the most serious. And the acellular pertussis vaccine has been out a long time for kids, and now they're starting to talk about it for adults. So it may be that every 10 years you will not get a tetanus booster. You will get a tetanus acellular pertussis booster.
Yeah, and there the thing is that for adults to get pertussis is not a problem for for the adult, but you don't want them to be a reservoir of the disease, so that then they might some infant might be exposed, because that's where really it is the serious problem. We don't want them to get.
Yeah. Plus, I guess adults don't want it either, because it is a 6-week long cough, and so yeah.
It's not
going to be fatal.
Fatal, but it's not pleasant.
You don't want to do that.
You don't want it. Yeah. Okay. Well, what else are we going to talk about here?
I don't know. It is medically boring this time of year.
Has the business of doing the basic physicals changed very much over time?
No. It's still the same old thing. And is it important? Yes. Is the physical exam important? Oh, maybe that's the least important part of the annual evaluation. A lot of pediatricians hated the annual physical. I always enjoyed it because it was a chance, especially with the older kids, to find out where they were at in their life, what they're doing. It was the old sex, drug, and rock and roll, where you can give preventive advice about that sort of thing. Find out how they're doing in school. Find out where they're going. Give them some advice about weight, if they're over or under. Give them some advice about activities, if they're in the super fit group. Kind of slow them down and see if you could normalize their life. And I thought the physical exam was very rewarding. I hope my patients were rewarded by it. But the number of abnormalities you're going to find on the physical exam are not very often.
Yeah. Well, are you going much beyond the, tapping the knees and looking in the ears and looking down the throat and listening to the heart?
I mean, yeah.
It's just sort of that basic sort of thing.
It's the same thing that's been going on for, a long time.
Yeah.
Except that I think, now we have more to consider sexual activity and drug use and maybe we don't have more to consider. Maybe we do. I think still the data shows that our teen pregnancy rate in this country right now is the lowest it's been since 1940-something or 1939 or something like that.
Yeah. Are kids, I would wonder if they would be reluctant to talk about some of those kinds of things with their parents, whether they would be all that forthcoming with you or with their pediatrician. I mean, did you find that they were actually felt comfortable in talking about things like that with you?
I think most of them, yeah. Especially if most of the teenagers wanted to come in without the parents present. And you'd make it, and you'd make a deal with them. You say, what we talk about here doesn't need to go to your parents. And that's true. We don't have, unless they are, by law, if they are threatening their life or somebody else's life, then we need to make that more public. That needs to be communicated to the parents or the authorities or something like that. But otherwise, we aren't under any obligation to share any information with the parents. And I don't think I've generally found out much that was, terribly surprising. I don't know that teenagers have changed a whole lot since we were teenagers about a century or so ago.
Not very many earth-shaking revelations?
No, I think there's still, Elvis Presley scandalized my parents. Probably about as much as I guess I don't listen to modern music, but probably is because I don't understand what they're saying. At least Elvis, I could understand what he was saying.
Something it comes up periodically and I just... I'm thinking about it because I think that there was I read about there being a rally having something to do with this recently, and I'm almost a little hesitant to bring up the subject because it is controversial. But there continue to be concerns that people have about possible harmful effects from immunization, and particularly now, one of the things that there seems to be a lot of concern about is mercury preservatives that are in some of the vaccines. There are some people who are very concerned about possible adverse health effects. I still think that the mainstream position of medicine is that these things are not harmful.
Yeah.
And they're not going to cause autism. They're not going to cause any problems. And yet, at the same time, there seem to be some number of parents and who are really very vocal, who are saying, we think that they should not be in the vaccines. They're saying, why in the world would you intentionally put mercury into a product that you're going to be putting into a child, knowing what we know about the bad effects of mercury. And so I think probably it's been going on for some time now.
I've been
calling on the government to say, okay, let's do something else. We're not going to use those kind of compounds in the vaccines anymore.
And they are disappearing. And I think by law they are disappearing. And I can't remember the cutoff date, but thiomerosal is the name of the product that has mercury, and it was put in vaccines as a preservative. And I guess most people say, even if it stays in the vaccine, the amount of mercury in there is so small that it's probably non-significant. But okay, mercury is a neurotoxin. Let's get it out of there. So mercury as a preservative will be disappearing from all the vaccines by I don't remember what date.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And again, the other one is measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. Does it cause autism? And again, nobody can find any data that it is causing that has anything to do with autism.
So, and certainly we have talked about this before. And I know what you're feeling, and I'm sure it's the feeling of a lot of other pediatricians that said the vaccines are a good thing, that there have been times, and maybe not all that long ago, that there were children who actually died from childhood disease. And that generally doesn't happen anymore. That's not to say that there can't be a bad outcome, but that
It's benefit, yeah.
It
benefit
seems that
risk,
but it seems that on the whole, it seems that the benefit outweighs the risk. So you would still say that, or in the past, if you would have said that to any parent who said, "Gee, is it really? Do I need to be worried about this?"
Yeah, I just said no. And again, there seems to be no good scientific data, and I expect it will be kicked around for years by the group, by that small but passionate group. And, we shouldn't put toxins in vaccines, and yes, they are being removed. Although, again, we had just read there is no scientific information that the amount of mercury in the vaccine is terribly significant.
Hmm.
Mercury's in our environment. We're exposed to it all the time. But, again, you just don't see – it is rare to see mercury – unless there's an industrial accident or something like that, it's rare to see mercury poisoning. I remember as a kid playing with mercury. It was fun, wasn't it? That little silver metal that rolled all over the place.
Yes.
And I think I'm okay. I'm not.
Is there any word so far, and I guess I haven't read anything about this for a while, about what's up with the flu vaccine situation and whether people will recall last year we had this problem with the flu vaccine that one of the major manufacturers, it was a British company, had apparently some sort of a problem with their manufacturing process. And so all of the vaccine that they made had to all be thrown away, which suddenly meant that we had about half of what it is that we thought we needed if we were going to just give the flu shots to everybody. And we said, okay, if you're in one of the high-risk groups, we've got vaccine for you. Everybody else, good luck. You're on your own. And also at that time, I think that federal officials, everybody said, well, we're gonna do our best to make sure that this doesn't happen again and that next year there will be enough vaccine. So everybody wants to get a flu shot can get one. And now it's been a while since I've heard anything about this, but it's not all that long now. It's not all that many months before we're going to come into that time. And I think that the process of making the vaccine should be now. They should be doing it right now if it's not already finished and in bottles and it has labels on it. Have you heard anything about
it? Not really. Not since that. Since they guaranteed that it would not happen again. that there's going to be more manufacturers. And fortunately, we did not have a flu. Yeah, we did not see much flu last year. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, my understanding is they threw away a lot of vaccine because a lot of people, even in the high-risk group, didn't get it. And I think that's always been a problem with the flu vaccine. How much, if I'm a manufacturer, how many doses do I make? I know how many people should get it, but I don't get paid unless somebody does get it. So mm-hmm. How many people who should get it are going to get it? And so I think it's an economic decision for these companies.
Is that the same thing when you talk about the vaccines for all of the standard childhood stuff that is recommended for all children to get, measles and chicken pox and whooping cough and you know, that whole series of stuff?
I think those were in good supply, except for the new meningococcal vaccine. I understand that's in very short supply. So for those of you who are sending your kids to college this year, it may not be available currently. Mm-hmm. It will be available, but currently there's a shortage of it.
Now, again, this is something that I'm confused about another thing that we've talked about a lot over the years, and every time that you see a little meningitis outbreak, it suddenly becomes news and people are concerned about it. And I'm sure that at that point, if you have kids in college or going to college, you start to think about it. Otherwise, it's not on your radar screen. You get other things to worry about. Now, apparently, it is recommended that young people who are going to college get this shot.
Yes.
Before they go.
Especially if they're going to live in. Actually, the recommendation is, I think it's for the 14 to 15-year-old. And hopefully that will, catch all these kids. Or if you haven't had it by 14 or 15 and you're going to college and living in a dormitory. Then where the confines are very close, where people are very close together. But to put this disease in perspective, I think there's like 1,500 deaths a year prior to the vaccine, as opposed to before Haemophilus influenza B vaccine came out, there were 15,000 deaths from that disease a year. So it's meningococcal meningitis is a relative bit. It's number one now, because when you get rid of the old number one, something has to fall in. Yeah, number two is going to fall into its place, but it's a relative bit player in the scheme of things. So it's a terrible disease, but it's an infrequent disease.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I remember in the past you saying something like generally, it's not something you need to worry about. But if there was an outbreak of meningitis, you said go get in the line and get your shot. Be at the head of the line. Otherwise, the rest of the time, it's not something you need to worry about. But it sounds like you would support it would go along with a recommendation that says whatever this is, 14, 15 years old now, have the shot.
Yeah, and my hope is that it will. Apparently, there's two spikes of illness with it. One is in adolescence. One is in early childhood. So my hope is that the supply of this vaccine will get large enough so we can give it to young children and prevent that first spike early in life. And the other interesting thing is measles, mumps, and rubella. Some companies coming out with the measles, mumps, rubella, chickenpox. So there is effort to condense the vaccine schedule, to combine vaccines.
So fewer sticks and...
less discomfort.
Yeah. How many are there now?
I don't know.
It's so many that you can't even, you can't even say, there's 30 or whatever it is.
There's a lot.
There's a lot.
There's a lot.
More than when...
Well, there's three hepatitis Bs. There's, and I guess it depends on the span you're counting. There's four DPTs, and then there's three pneumococcals, and there's an MMR, and then there's a couple of chicken pox, and actually there's two MMRs. Again, depends what, how many years you're counting for. So there's a bunch. But again, these are diseases that were killers. Maybe not chicken pox so much, but these are diseases that you just didn't want to get. The other thing I was reading about in one of the journals, the left brain, right brain sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And this journal, this article, and I'll have to find more literature on this, was how important the left brain is mainly language, logic, and apparently it doesn't come into effect till about 18 months, 2 years of age. And apparently there's a markedly differential growth between the left brain and the right brain. And the right brain starts developing. It myelinizes sooner. It does everything sooner. And it starts developing in prenatal life. And it's probably done most of its growth by 18 months to 2 years. And that's the part of the brain that's very important in attachment. And it's almost like it's important for human beings to imprint on a primary caregiver, usually, again, the mother. Mm-hmm. It was kind of an interesting article, and I'll have to wait for more data and go through the bibliography and come out with books. But apparently, if you don't make appropriate maternal attachments, or could be paternal to a primary caregiver, the left or the right brain is important for regulation of emotions and regulation of attention and all that sort of stuff later on. So it sounds like I'm fascinated by it.
Hmm.
And
well, we have a caller to talk with. Let me introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician and a clinical assistant professor at the U of I. Once a month, always on a Thursday, he's here on the program. We talk about children's health, and we have been doing that for a long time. The idea being that we thought there would always be questions about children's health, and it would be a good thing to have a doctor here regularly on the program who could respond. So whatever's on your mind, just, you know, the kind of things that you could talk about with a pediatrician, you can call in and talk with us. 333-9455. That's here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. We have someone here in Mahomet, and they're on a cell phone. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. Since it seems to be a rather slow day, I thought I'd ask you to talk a bit about three subjects, two of which are actually related to what you were just talking about. The first one has to do with the development of the judgment centers in a child's brain, and how important that is for parents to realize that children can't be expected to be adults when that center hasn't developed yet. Related to that, sort of like if you have a dog, you know, your dog could be smart, but it's still going to be a dog, and you can't expect it to be doing calculus. Children are very impulsive and don't understand things about long-term repercussions. And parents often sit down with their children when they're having some problems and talk to them like they were adults when they don't understand. The children can't understand what that means at all. The second thing would be to talk a bit about children's sleep cycles, particularly adolescents.
Okay.
One of our big issues here is that we are basically educating children in a time period that's convenient for the teachers to get up and teach, but students they're not awake. Their timing is completely different, and I guess the general topic is, we need to understand that children aren't little adults, and we need to accommodate them as well as introduce them into becoming adults, but not to to push them into it. And the last thing, which I just wanted to mention, I just remembered what it was, is I was in a coffee shop, and I was talking to a woman, and she was with a child, and she was describing her kid to me, and I said, you know, your kid's an Aspie. She says, what? I said, your child has Asperger's. And she said, God, that's terrible. What is it? And I explained it to her. I have Asperger's, and it's not a debilitating disease. It's just something, the way you are, and it has to do with the system, as you know, the systemizing ability of boys, and it comes into gender differences. And, like, for example, she wanted to take her boy to see a movie about penguins to make the kid more sensitive. And I said, well, the kid isn't going to become more sensitive because it's not in his nature to be sensitive towards penguins. And myself, I was 50-something years old before I was diagnosed, and my doctor didn't know what it was. And it turns out that most doctors, and this includes psychiatrists, don't understand what this is. And it's, since it's such a major gender-based difference, I think it would be helpful if you talked about that a little also. And I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay. Sure.
Yeah, Alzheimer's, I had a patient with it once that, yeah, I didn't know much about it. It fits in with the... It's in the autism spectrum of disorders, and it's fairly mild, and I think that's why, you know, the child who has terrible interpersonal relationship skills and communication skills, you say, man, there's something wrong with this kid, obviously, but the Alzheimer's child or adult isn't that way. They're just, I guess they're just a little... you know, they're normal but peculiar, I guess, is maybe the best way to say it, and that's why they're not diagnosed as much. And it is, again, it's a relational problem. It's a, to a certain extent, communication problem, and these people tend to pull themselves under pressure into sort of a, I guess, a world of imagination. I don't know if you'd agree with that. They just kind of withdraw. And but they're with it, but they're sort of not with it. They're withdrawn. This left brain, right brain stuff, this imprinting stuff, actually there was an apology by the editor in this journal that this was a terribly uncommon article, because usually they talk about measles or vaccinations or diseases or something like that. And this is, I think, early research of neurobiology into the left brain and right brain, and how, in essence, we have two brains. The right brain is different from the left brain, and the right brain matures much earlier, and it seems to be important in autoregulation and attention. And you're right. It seems to have matured by, or be myelinated at least. I mean, I'm sure neurologic connections are still being made in there by age 18 months or 2 years, before the right brain or before the left brain comes in. And again, the left brain is probably has more to do with cognition and logic and reason and that sort of stuff. So you're absolutely right. It probably isn't terribly worthwhile to spend much time trying to reason with an 18-month-old, because that part of their neurologic system is really not terribly functional yet. And we do, you're absolutely right. Kids aren't little adults. Kids are still developing. Their brain's developing. Body systems are developing. And we can't treat kids as little adults. We've got to treat kids as kids and help them develop these various systems.
I'll tell you what. I want to come back to this sleep thing, because that's something we've talked about before. But we have another caller. So rather than make them wait, why don't we go and take this caller, and then we'll come back to this, particularly when it comes to sleep and teenagers or something.
Yeah.
We definitely have talked about that before. We'll get back to that. Let's go to Champagne for another caller. This is line two. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a question with regards to the connection between autism, mercury, and vaccinations. I've got friends who have an autistic child, and you read all kinds of things on the internet, and part of something I read was arguing that there was a connection between high levels of mercury and vaccinations that were done a few years ago. Is there any, or do you have any, give any credence to those arguments?
There seems to be no scientific. People have looked at that, and they can't see. There are very low levels of mercury in this. It may not even be absorbable. It may be bound and may not be free mercury, so it may not essentially function as mercury, even though we're injecting this into the child. But the bulk of the scientific evidence says that vaccines seem to have no ill effects, unless you're allergic to the vaccine or something like that. But the stabilizing agents, the preservative agents, and the vaccines themselves do not cause autism or any kind of neurologic toxicity.
I see. And as a parent, are there things that we need to be careful of for small children in terms of, I don't know, maybe high fish intake, things like that, where you have high mercury levels, or does there not to be seen any connection between mercury and autism, or what should we look? What should we be doing at a practical level as parents?
You know, that I'm aware of, there's no connection between autism and mercury, although mercury, again, is a neurotoxin. And I think the dosage, certainly if you give people a ton of mercury, you can kill them. But I think, you know, and we do worry about mercury in our fish and contaminating our environment. And the fish at the top of the food chain are the ones that eat the little fish, so they... It was like the old DDT. They store this mercury, so the higher up the food chain, the more little fish with mercury they've eaten, so they've increased their mercury levels. So the bigger the fish, the more mercury. But then, okay, fish is high in omega-3 fatty acids, which is good to prevent and help to prevent heart disease. So we're supposed to eat a lot of fish, but it's confusing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think the data to the best of my knowledge, this I don't think we have good data yet. I think there is concern about it, but I don't think we have any data about how much fish you can eat and what the real... we know there's mercury in the fish, but what significance is it? And my feeling at this time is the significance is, especially in Central Illinois, we're probably not going to eat that many fish. We probably don't have to... You know, if you have fish a couple of times a week, you don't need to worry about the mercury. If you live on Lake Michigan, you do a lot of salmon fishing in the lake or lake trout fishing, and you're eating lake trout 7 days a week, there's probably reason to be concerned.
I see.
Or maybe reason to be concerned. But I think going to your local fish market or the store and having fish once a week or a couple of times a week, I don't think there's any reason to be concerned.
Do you think the root of autism is kind of a random genetic selection or something that might be caused by the environment, or we're still not sure?
I think we have no knowledge. I don't think we have any much understanding of the etiology, the causative factor of autism and the autism spectrum of disorders.
Okay. Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Okay. Right. Isn't it also the case that people are asking the question, is it... Yes, we are identifying more children with autism, but we're also now looking for it more carefully.
Yeah.
We're thinking about it, and so that invites this question, well, are there really more children with autism, or are we simply now making the diagnosis more than we have in the past?
Yeah, and I think there's a difference. Some people say it's increasing in frequency. Some people say, yeah, we're just diagnosing it more. And we've got this now. We don't call it autism. We call it the autism spectrum of disorders, with again Asperger's syndrome probably being one of the most mild forms. And I'm not clear if it's really increasing in frequency or if we're just getting sharper about diagnosing it.
Let's go back to the sleep question, which the other caller raised, and this is indeed something that we've talked about before.
Yeah, this is a good. I think this is something really worth talking to. About. And I think it's really worth something for our educational system to reevaluate what they do, and it's been reevaluated in some school systems. Minneapolis mainly is one I'm aware of, and it seems that people need about 8 hours of sleep a night. The problem is what happens in adolescence is all of a sudden their biologic clock seems to change, and this seems to be very real. This isn't a goofy teenager. This isn't a lazy adolescent. Their clock just seems to reset, so they stay up later at night, and they still need their 8 hours of sleep, so that means they have to sleep later in the morning. So if we start our school if school starts at 7 a.m. and they have to get up, especially the girls because they've got to get their hair done and all that sort of stuff, so they're up at 5:30 getting ready, they're down to 5 or 6 hours of sleep instead of 8, so we're sending them to school sleep deprived. And so they can't concentrate as well, or maybe they doze off. And there is some evidence that if we change the school hours, particularly for the adolescents, and some articles I've read suggest that in general in this country, the adolescents start school, the secondary level starts school before the primary level, because we want to let little kids get their sleep. But little kids are up at 6 o'clock in the morning anyway. And that really we ought to start our high school, our secondary education, at a later hour. It would fit in more with what their natural biology is. And I recently heard a teacher complain that, boy, she's glad school's over because she gets to sleep. So we've got sleep-deprived teachers, too. Yeah, there are some studies. There was one done in Minneapolis that I'm aware of where they just moved their high school starting time, I think an hour later. And what they found is they had less kids in the counselor's office. They had less disruptions in the classroom, less fights in the hallway. And I don't remember that they looked at SAT scores or anything like that, but I think this can be very important, too. In this day and age of No Child Left Behind and mass testing, the testing ought to be done in the afternoon, not first thing in the morning, because they're a little bit more alert and awake. But, yeah, our school seems not to be designed to the biologic clock of the adolescent in particular.
Mm-hmm. I'm all for it. Let's start everything later.
And bring back the afternoon nap.
If someone wanted to call real quick, I'm sure we'd get in a call in the time we have remaining here with Dr. Bocek. We got a couple minutes left, 333-WILL or 9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Is there any last little thing that we could talk about?
Again, it's hot. Again, your child's been out of school for a couple months. The library is very good. Have them read a book at home. Kind of keep their reading skills up that way, and hopefully they'll find out that reading is fun.
Yeah. Here we have a call. How about that? We'll talk to this person here in Urbana. Line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
How important is breastfeeding in the first few weeks of a baby's life?
It is recommended. And I think as time goes on, we find out more and more special things about breastfeeding. Is it vital? No. Is it important? We think so, yes. Because there are unique features about breast milk that are not present in cow's milk, and formula is basically cow's milk taken apart and put back together. So if breastfeeding can be done, do it for... a reasonable length of time. And usually what I'd recommend is, 9 to 12 months of age when weaning seems to go on in this country. But certainly the earlier, yeah.
How often how strongly do doctors encourage mothers to breastfeed?
I hope they do it very strongly, because I know the American Academy of Pediatrics strongly supports breastfeeding. I'm sure Dr. Troopman would say that ACOG, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, strongly supports it. I'm sure the Family Practice Association does it. And I would hope, if you had a misfortune where somebody didn't encourage it?
Well, I don't know if it was encouraged or not. My stepdaughter's had two babies, and each time she took a couple months off work, and neither time did she breastfeed.
Okay.
So I wondered if her doctor was even suggesting it.
Yeah, I would hope that her physician did, because I think there's very little doubt that there are unique things in breast milk that aren't present in formula, and it's beneficial for the baby.
Is there a disadvantage if you can only breastfeed for, say, 2 to 8 weeks?
You didn't
have to switch over to formula because you go back to work.
Not that we can measure.
Okay.
I can't say that, I don't think anybody would be willing to say that the non-breastfed baby is 10 IQ points short of the breastfed baby.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking of immune factors and things such as that.
And fortunately, we aren't like other mammals where if you don't get nursed, you don't survive.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks. And it is that the interest in trying to promote breastfeeding is it's not merely a kind of a nutritional thing. There are other things, beneficial things that are in the breast milk, and that things that confer some kind of immunity that are passed from the mother to the baby. Yeah. That is what we're talking about.
And then if we get into that right brain thing I was talking about earlier, this imprinting, this attachment to a primary caregiver, you say, man, breastfeeding sure is going to help that.
It's a bonding, a bonding exercise too. Well, we've talked about. Oh, I don't know. I was going to ask real quick. I've been reading some things, and again, given the concern we have about West Nile, that apparently there are some people in the health field that think that Americans aren't paying enough attention to trying to avoid being bitten by mosquitoes.
You know, I did hear your entomologist who was on
May.
Phil, who said that the problem with the mosquito that carries West Nile and St. Louis encephalitis is they don't buzz.
They're sneaky. Yes.
They're sneaky. The other thing I will say is I read an article about West Nile, and they looked at people who lived near the Nile River in Egypt and found out that almost all of them had antibodies to West Nile virus. And they were all bright alert walking around. So, yeah, the encephalitis of West Nile and St. Louis encephalitis and the other enteroviral encephalitises can be a disaster, but it's a bird disease. Mm-hmm. Occasionally, rarely a human being gets in the way.
Okay.
So I think it's – I don't like to be bit by a mosquito because it's uncomfortable, it itches, and I think I'd worry more about that than – well, you can't do anything about, there's no immunization, so you can't. So don't worry about things you can't do anything about.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Dr. Robert Bocek, he's a pediatrician, clinical assistant professor at U of I, and was with us once a month, always on Thursday. We talk about children's health.